Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a weekly program of conversations with writers in the studios of North State Public Radio. Now here's your host, Nancy Wiegman.
Today I'm going to be talking about autism with my guest, Dr. Lisa Benarin. Dr. Benarin is a graduate of Yale Medical School and is board certified in pediatrics, internal medicine, and neurodevelopmental disabilities. She is the medical director of the Far Northern Regional Center in Chico, where she provides evaluations for individuals of all ages suspected of having an autistic spectrum disorder. Dr. Benarin has just written a book entitled Autism. And Dr. Benarin, welcome.
Thank you so much.
It's called autistic spectrum disorder because we're discovering that this is a spectrum,
right,
and not just one single thing that we can pin down. And for you, writing this book was more than just an academic exercise. You have experience in your own family.
That's
with
correct,
autism.
Right. That's how my it's hard to really call it an interest. It's more involvement, deep immersion in autism started was that my ex-husband has a son who's now 20 years old, who has autism, and actually he's probably 19, going on 20 just very soon. And living with him intermittently, he mainly lived with his mother, but when he'd come with us, it was clear that he had this whole world with all these rules, but the rules were not apparent to us as members of sort of the typical social world.
And you were a pediatrician.
Oh, yeah. And just like most pediatricians, though, I had limited experience with autism, although I've tried to rack my brain to remember exactly what it was because I was at a center that actually specializes in autism. Yale has a very famous department that deals with autism in the Child Developmental Center where they have Fred Volkmer and Ami Klin, who are, you know, big names in autism. And then my residency at University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill was also a big autism center where they have developed this program called the TEACH program. And it was actually the place where they really started some of the early programs.
I believe you met Jake. His name was Jake.
Yeah.
I believe you met him at just the age when autism starts to
right.
make itself known.
Right.
The symptoms begin to appear.
Right. He, you know, it was obvious the first time I met him that he had autism.
Mm-hmm.
And but that was, you know, his story with his family was really, really a typical story, which is that, you know, at first maybe they thought he was deaf and that's why he wasn't really responding. And that's the classic main reason for referral is these speech delays where they think, gosh, you know, he's not responding at all. Maybe he's deaf. And that's sort of one of the routes that people come to us for autism evaluations is through the audiologists who see these kids to test their hearing and instantly recognize that these kids
have
autism. It's not a hearing problem. Yeah. And so that's what they thought was going on with him. And then they thought, well, maybe it's just a speech and language delay. And then the grandparents have continued to think, no, it's hearing, even though the test sort of suggested it wasn't. So he went that route. And actually, back then, he went to Stanford. And at age, I think it was around 3.5, and they didn't even diagnose autism. They said pervasive developmental disorder, not otherwise specified, which is also called atypical autism, which is sort of you don't meet the complete criteria for autism. But he did. There is not a kid that's more classic, sort of the classic kind of autism that's instantly recognizable that more than Jake. So I think that really reflects how the whole diagnostic process has changed over the years, where it used to be people really didn't want to commit themselves to a diagnosis until 4 or 5 because kids are developing and changing. Whereas now the big push is to identify as early as possible, before 3 and even 18 months now.
In fact, I happened to meet a young man. He happened to wait. I went out to dinner. Mm-hmm. And the young man said he'd had, and I believe maybe when he was 2 years old, and he took them to your center
right.
and got a diagnosis. And then after some time passed, he was no longer autistic. And
right.
so the waiter was thinking, oh, well, there was a mistake in the diagnosis.
Right.
But you make the point in your book and use the phrase, they can lose the diagnosis.
Right. Yeah. You know, deciding what phrase to use there is sort of a controversial thing. That some people will say they're cured of their autism. And
it's kind of like outgrowing it, that they have it
right?
at 2, but at 3.
Right. And most people that talk about the cure are actively doing things that aside from the mainstream treatments. Some people are just doing the mainstream treatments, the mainstream meaning educational programs that have been designed for people with autism. But some people are doing these biomedical kind of kind of treatments. And then that's the main group that really talks about cures.
Well, but, I think this young man maybe just didn't realize that it's a process.
Right.
That his child did in fact have right. the symptoms of autism, but then it wasn't
away.
A misdiagnosis. That's right. just the right. the nature of the beast
right.
you're
and
dealing
it,
with.
And I used to think that when I was reviewing other charts that it was misdiagnosis, but then I started doing my own and seeing them, and I read my note and it was clear. And then I see the kid later, and it's a different kid. And what happens is that usually the kids have a speech and language delay, and it can be a fairly significant speech and language delay. That's the other main route that they get referred in. So hearing, I think he's deaf, and then mm-hmm. speech and language delay, and so speech and language delays that are severe, they actually influence your socialness. You need speech to be social. In fact, there is a study where they took people that were deaf and people that signed. And people that signed had an imaginary world and were much more social, where people that didn't have any sign language, their social development really didn't progress, and they actually looked more like people with autism. So you need language to be social. And so if you're two-ish or two-and-a-half and you don't have language, you don't know what's going to happen as they develop their language. It can take a couple different trajectories, developmental trajectories. It can, as language increases, the socialness can increase, and the funny behaviors, the tendency to just push buttons and things, gets replaced by more social behaviors. Or the language can not improve, and they stay sort of how we saw them initially. Or the language improves, but their socialness doesn't.
So one of the controversies in autism, just in general, I'm talking, by the way, to Dr. Lisa Benera, and her book is Autism, and diagnosing is one of the controversies. There's
right.
just this problem is just hard to get your hands around something
right.
concrete in the
right.
diagnosis. And then the causes, that's what really stirs people up.
Right.
When somebody heard I was going to be talking to a doctor who specialized in autism, that's the question that immediately popped in his head. Well, do vaccines
right.
cause autism?
Right.
Because one place I read that it's easy to scare people.
Right.
It's very hard to unscare people.
Right.
So once people have been scared and they have this notion that vaccines cause autism, it's really hard to get that notion
out.
Yes.
Well, vaccines have been demonized for a long time. And I talk about this in my book a little bit that, there was this book, I think it was in the 60s called A Shot in the Dark. And it was about the pertussis, DPT vaccine. And, so for a while it was that vaccine that was really demonized. And then for a while it was the oral polio virus, because polio had really been wiped out in the United States. And the only cases of polio we saw at that time were ones that were caused by the virus. So yes, it prevented this big disease from reestablishing in the United States, but the disease wasn't present really in the United States, so people would say, well, why should I immunize my child? And it's this whole thing that we call herd immunity, and, we are just a herd of people. And viruses and bad infections can't establish unless there's people to infect. And so if everybody's immunized, then those people don't get the disease, whatever it is, and then they don't pass it on, and you don't get these outbreaks or epidemics. And so one of the consequences of this fear of the vaccines is that the immunization rates are falling, and all over Europe and the United States, measles, mumps, and rubella cases are going up. Well, it's not. Yeah, it is measles and mumps. First, it was just measles, but now mumps is reemerging, and it hasn't been really a problem for a while. And so there's this thought that now, if the vaccine, the rate of uptake, it's called, the number of people that have the vaccines, if that falls, we could see more and more of these outbreaks. And then people will start dying from measles, because people do die of measles.
Well, the study that came out, I think it was about 1998, that first is a biochemist in London says,
right.
oh, this is the problem.
Right.
And when people really looked into his research, first of all, it was 12 children.
Right.
And the research really didn't bear out what he was declaring to
right,
be the
right.
case. And it's the evidence that he was off track is
right.
is just overwhelming.
Yeah. The problem is that within any kind of statement, there's some part truths and some – there's truths that sort of back it up and things that don't back it up. So that paper was actually, he was a gastroenterologist. His name was Andrew Wakefield, and he's a very charming guy, a really persuasive speaker. I mean, you go in there and, you know, I almost was, you know, I almost came out thinking, yeah. And he talks to audiences that pretty much believe what he's saying. So that's sort of one thing. But what he said in the paper was he took this mishmash of people. Some of them had autistic spectrum disorders and some of them had other developmental delays. And then he specifically asked people when they noticed symptoms in relation to the measles, mumps, and rubella. And when you do that, there's this intrinsic bias that gets built in terms of recall. All of our recalls aren't so great.
In fact, I read that the symptoms had come before.
Right, a lot of them.
Before they got vaccinated.
Right, exactly. And so, you know, one of the things that's happening now is that we are identifying kids earlier and earlier. And so one of the things that identified kids earlier was this study of head circumference that showed that starting at around 6 months of age and going on through around four, but really being at its maximum between like 6 and 18 months of age, the head circumference of kids with autism in general grows more. And that starts at 6 months, right? So if you could document that that started, but the symptoms aren't necessarily noticed then, they're usually not noticed until 12 months or farther on. And so the measles, mumps, and rubella gets given at 12 months. So you get the measles, mumps, and rubella, and everyone says, look, my kid's autism started around 12 months. But that's when you notice that the kids aren't talking. If your kid hasn't said a word until 12 months, well, you're not that concerned. You know, maybe they're just a little late. Who knows? And people tend to say, well, he's had a lot of ear infections. And it's been pretty much shown that a lot of ear infections do not delay speech development.
In fact, you make this point in your book, and this point is made elsewhere, that coincidence does not mean causation.
Right.
Just because two things happened at the same time doesn't mean one caused the other.
Right.
And people are quick because they get their kids vaccinated about the same time symptoms appear. It's like, oh, my gosh, this must have caused it. And so parents are upset. And when a charming guy, like you mentioned, this distinguished gentleman from London, tells you that vaccines cause autism, people want to believe such a charming man.
Right.
And then they have somebody like the actor, what's his name? Jim Carrey.
Right, right.
Has a wife Jenny McCarthy, who's an attractive blonde. But if you have that kind of platform, you have a millionaire movie star on your side and you're a blonde model actress, then people are going to listen to what you say.
Right.
And so she writes a book and says that, my gosh, vaccine caused my child's autism.
Right.
And people are going to be listening to her, whereas people like you who write a book, your voice doesn't get heard as loudly.
Right. Well, I didn't expect my voice to be heard very loudly because this was really written for a reference text company that sells to libraries. But I was pleased to see, I looked it up on the internet, that it's in a number of really good universities. It's at Yale, it's at Harvard, it's at Vanderbilt. So there is a little book there in the library. And if people want to know from the beginning of the story, how everything is played out and all the complicated pieces of it, then they can read this book and then they will know how to interpret all of the data.
So when they see a report or when they see an actress claiming that the vaccines caused her child's autism, they can know the fuller picture.
Right.
And
when you see
and judge and evaluate these reports.
Exactly. So recently, you know, there's what's headlines. There was a decision by the Federal Vaccine Court that said the headlines were MMR.
Now, that's something
I
think people may not realize, that there is such a thing as a Federal Vaccine Court.
Right, right. So, yes, there is a vaccine court. And if you are prone to sort of theories that there's this underground network of people that are, you know, conspiring to keep immunizations on the market to make money for the pharmaceutical companies, then the vaccine court is something that that sort of seems to sort of prove that a little or provide evidence for that. Because what the vaccine court is that, like I said, that the vaccines have been demonized for a long time. And so there were court cases for these various vaccines and against the vaccines claiming that they caused this problem. And what was happening was that the vaccine manufacturers were just going to go out of the business. They don't really feel an obligation to continue to market a product that's going to get sued all the time. And so what happened was, because pediatricians are big believers in immunizations, because they've seen some things like polio go away, you know, FDR had polio, people got polio, and it causes a lot of problems. And so they've seen this go away, and so they say, look, this is a good thing. And in my generation, I saw meningitis from this thing called Haemophilus influenza B, HIB. I saw that go away. And, you know, if you spent time in the ICU like me watching these babies be devastated by this disease, and it's virtually gone, residents now don't ever see it because everyone gets immunized. So it does make you a believer, you know. And so what happened was that in order to preserve the immunizations, they had to make this court, and they have this reporting system called VAERS, and it's Vaccine Adverse Events Reporting System.
So that parents can feel that they are being heard.
Heard, right. And then those get reviewed. And if it's clear, if it's deemed clear that your child's problems really started within, I think it's 48 hours of a vaccination, then you get compensated for that. And there are some things that show up right at the time of a vaccination. But one case that was very, very famous that just happened recently was a case of a little girl who had her immunizations and then had seizures that were intractable, wouldn't go away, and then her developmental course just went completely downhill from that. And it was an MMR vaccine, so they said, aha.
Measles, mumps, rubella.
Right, sorry, mm-hmm. Yep. And she was diagnosed with autism. And so everyone said, look, she got this, she had this catastrophic course. This is clearly related. Well, they actually found for that family and compensated them. But the issue was that the father was a neurologist who was just going to find out what this was no matter what. And he pursued the workup to figure it out. And she has this thing called a mitochondrial disorder, which is an inborn problem. And with mitochondrial disorders, what happens is you can't make enough energy, the ATP and the mitochondria, you know, it's the energy powerhouse of the body. And you can't make enough energy. So if there's a stress on the body, the brain doesn't get enough food and you end up with brain damage. And so she had this inborn thing. And then the stress on the body was of the fever associated with the vaccine, which a lot of us get. Most of us don't have this underlying disease.
Genetic
that
problem.
Predisposes us to have a horrible outcome. So it could have been influenza that she got, but that gave her the bad fever that led to the downhill thing.
But it happened to have been the vaccination.
It happened to be the MMR. Mm-hmm. So then you see the headlines, MMR causes autism. That's one way to summarize the case, but it's very misleading in my opinion.
So that's why we as consumers need to have this foundation, this background
right.
that you have in your book, so that when we see a headline like that, we know that headline is not the whole story.
Right, exactly.
Dr. Benarin's book is Autism. After a break, I'll continue my conversation with Dr. Benarin. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm back with Dr. Lisa Benarin, author of Autism. And the causes of autism are what everybody wants to know because the incidence of autism has just skyrocketed.
Right.
I mean, it was only a few years ago, I mean, in my lifetime, that there wasn't even such a thing as diagnosis. They call it what schizophrenia.
Or, right, right.
And all of a sudden, this has just become such a problem.
Right.
In California, I understand that it went from about 6.2 per 10,000 births to 42.5 per 10,000 births just in 2001. So,
And that's a
really
complicated story.
Figuring out what the incidence is,
right.
You're saying. Yeah.
Right.
Even
yeah.
just deciding what the incidence
right.
is. Because if it's hard to diagnose, then who do you include in
right.
this? And there's such a spectrum of children who—
Where do you draw the lines?
Yeah. People right. like Temple Grandin, mm-hmm. who has a PhD and has written books herself. She's autistic.
Yeah, but all you have to do is spend 5 minutes with Temple. I had the the honor of having lunch with her.
Oh.
And she's just, you know, there's no doubt. The eye contact is terrible. Her voice has a quality that's very much like this.
In fact, you know what? One day I turned on the radio and I thought, oh, that voice just doesn't sound like the
right.
voice you normally hear on the
right.
radio. It was distinctive.
Right, because it doesn't have the ebbs and flow that we call prosody that's part of expressive speech. And mm-hmm. that the Europeans think the Americans don't have because they are so much, you know, a lot of them are much more expressive.
And yet here's a person who's made such a contribution right. to our understanding of animals.
Right.
I just appreciate so much that she's written these books.
Well, she talks
about
a lot
animals.
About instinct and how animal instincts control their behavior, and that she feels at some level that people with autism understand instincts because they react. They don't have the social context of situations to influence how they're seeing things. And so sometimes it's just based on just a pure, you know, internal interpretation, which is really not influenced by the outside world. That's sort of instinct.
I'm talking to Dr. Lisa Bonera, and her book is Autism, and we're puzzling over the causes. Is it we talked about the early history, even thought, well, because the mother was a
yes.
cold person.
Yes.
And so there was this refrigerator mother.
Yes, that was a terrible, terrible thing. Although,
yeah, to make mothers feel guilty
yeah.
that they weren't warm right. enough toward their child, and therefore right. their child had autism. And right. so that's pretty much fallen by the wayside.
Absolutely. But, you know, that was a trend in general. That's when they used to call mm-hmm. women with the depressive disorders, you know, hysterical.
Mm-hmm.
And so there was a long history of sort of this patriarchal dismissal of women.
But one, I don't know that it has gone away, and that is that parent age, the age of a parent.
Right.
If a parent is older.
Right. That fits into this whole big theme that I try to pull together what we know. So people say, is it true that if you're older, you know, that there's more? And is it just the father or is it the mother? And is it true that you know, they'll mention lots of different things. Is it true that if you have a family history of it, that it's more common? And there's sort of a unifying theory that sort of covers all these things, which is that the mainstream scientists have felt for a long time that autism was a genetic disorder, meaning that it had to do with genes that are changed in some way. And in families where lots of different people have autism in the family, there's clearly something in that family that is getting expressed that's getting passed on from person to person. In the families where there's only one, people say, well, there's no family history. I don't have a history of it, so how could it be genetic? And the way it could be genetic is there's two big ways that it could be genetic. So this is an answer to people saying, if autism is genetic, why is it increasing? Because Down syndrome is genetic and it's kind of staying around the same, and these other the syndromes are around the same. You have X amount of genes and they get passed around, and this is the incidence of that problem. But what they're finding is that as they get more and more technology to be able to analyze the whole genome, all the chromosomes all at once, instead of picking an area and looking at just one and doing it sort of piecemeal, they found that there are these little areas of what's called deletions. So when the chromosomes are copying, a little bit gets left out, or duplications, where a little bit gets copied in more numbers. So you might have two or three copies of this little part of the gene. And depending on where those little copies are, either the gene doesn't work at all, it doesn't make what it's supposed to make, and so it doesn't do its function, it doesn't do its job, or the gene works some, but not as good as it should. And so those genes that they found that are associated with autism are all genes that are involved in making connections between different parts of the brain.
So mainstream scientists now are really is brain research
right.
that they're on right now. Would you say that that's the current place they're looking for?
Right. Yeah. In general, this has been thought to be a neurodevelopmental disorder localized in the brain. And there's all sorts of different reasons to think that. And one of them is that, you know, there were these autopsy studies that showed that the brains didn't look completely normal. The cellular structure was different. And then they in some places but not others, and then they do MRI or CT scans that showed these changes. But the changes, it's important to recognize, can't be used to diagnose autism on an individual basis. It's in the big group of autism there were these changes.
Well, we talked about the fact that the incidence of autism has increased so dramatically, but one thing that did not increase the incidence of autism was when they removed that preservative. People say, right. oh, thimerosal is terrible. Right. We need right. to take that preservative right. out of the right. vaccines. Right. And so it was taken out, and guess what?
Yeah, it changed. I mean, it didn't change. what we would have expected was if thimerosal was a big player in this whole process, then when it was taken out, and they started the process in 99 and it was finished in 2001, and people who still believe that thimerosal is a bad thing focus on the fact that it's still in the flu vaccine, although there are flu vaccines without, and that it was dialyzed out of the immunization, so there was a little bit left. But the total body burden went from something like 300 or 400 micrograms of mercury down to about 5, you know. So, and that's more, you get way more than that in a tuna sandwich. So, it's not the thimerosal, although everybody agrees that it's probably not a good idea.
Yeah, probably a good idea to have taken the thimerosal out of the vaccines.
Heavy metals are bad.
Yeah, so it's not a good idea to have them in there, but that wasn't the solution that people thought it might be.
And from a public health perspective, it did make sense because there were a lot of lives saved in these multi-dose vials. If they get contaminated, it can kill the people that get it. And that's what happened. So that's why it was only in multi-dose vials and it was only in vaccines that were not live. So there was no thimerosal ever in measles, mumps, and rubella because that's a live attenuated vaccine, meaning it's live virus, but that gets sort of – they mess around with it to make it so that it's not as lethal. It's not as dangerous. So
all of these causes that we think at one time or another might be the cause have proven maybe to be a little bit, but maybe not at all. And then that creates a problem with how do you treat something if you don't know what causes it?
Right. Well, let me just say one last thing on the genetics is that the genetics is probably, I'm a believer in the fact that it's probably genetic related. And the environmental factors like pesticides can alter your genes. So there's being more and more attention to that. So I think
So decreasing pesticides in our environment can help?
Probably, although the problem is most of these are persistent organic pollutants like DDT that stick around for a long time. Mm-hmm. So I think we are closing in on the causes. One of the issues that's a problem is that we put people with all sorts of different problems in the group. So about 20% of the people in the autism group have other medical problems. They were preemies that had a terrible course. They have a different genetic syndrome. They have this, they have that. And those people probably have really different causes than the other 80%.
So if I'm a parent and I come to you and you tell me my child has autism, then obviously I want you to cure my child.
Well, yeah. Although, yeah, you do. Well, I think it's a universal desire for all parents that their kids do well, that they have a chance.
Because if you can't cure him, then is he going to be able to go to kindergarten? Right. Is he going to be able to one day to get married? Can he have children? What happens when I die?
Right.
Who's going to take care of my child?
Of course. Those are all the typical. I mean, those are the normal parental concerns. I mean, who wouldn't feel that way? But what we try to focus on is right now we can't predict how well your kid's going to do. All we can predict is that all we know is that, yes, your kid fits into this category. And now we're going to intervene and the best predictor of how they're going to do is how they do. I know that's not satisfying in some ways, but in a way, but it is the truth.
I've been talking to Dr. Lisa Benarin. Her book is Autism. I'm Nancy Wiegman. I'm Nancy Wiegman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. My next guest is freelance journalist Ethan Waters. He says we're teaching the world how we define and treat mental illnesses like anorexia, schizophrenia, post-traumatic stress disorder, and depression. Ethan Waters, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me on the show.
You know, your book was so interesting, and as I was reading it, I thought, why didn't somebody write this book sooner? Why did it take so long? This idea about the globalization of the American psyche. How did you happen to be in a position to write this book?
Well, that's an interesting question. It goes back many years for me. The first book I wrote in the middle 90s was about the recovered memory controversy, where women were going into therapy and recovering memories of being abused by satanic cults, but also displaying this very florid symptoms of multiple personality disorder. And so I wrote a book about that, basically making the point that these memories and illnesses were being shaped by the process of psychotherapy that these women were going through, which at the time was a very controversial thing to say, is less controversial now. But that knowledge, that idea that the mental health profession shapes the illnesses that it then goes to treat, stuck with me for many years. And I began to think again about it just a few years ago in terms of globalization and how America is so important in the rest of the world in shaping the treatments of illnesses, the drug treatments, the categories. And in doing so, I think there's a lack of understanding that because culture and mental illnesses are always combined a little bit, cultural ideas about the symptoms of a mental illness, how it progresses, how people look at the mentally ill person all coalesce to shape the experience of the illness itself. So it occurred to me that we might indeed be, in taking our ideas to the rest of the world, we might indeed be shaping not only the treatments and the ideas that surround these illnesses, but the illnesses themselves. And then I went into this world of cross-cultural psychiatry and I found the scholars that were charting exactly this. And so basically the book is profiling four different cases of where we are indeed affecting another culture's understanding, not only of the treatment of mental illness, but the mental illness itself.
But, and we feel we are morally right to do this. There's a moral certainty.
Yeah. So some people, I think that even within the drug companies, even as they profit from this, they tell themselves the story of this is just like a polio vaccine. SSRIs or antidepressants are just like a polio vaccine. And the rest of the world, it's a moral imperative that the rest of the world has these drugs. And that's not a totally invalid argument. You know, SSRIs, I'm not my wife is a psychiatrist. I'm not against the drugs.
In fact, you don't reveal that until later in the book.
I kept thinking, conclusion.
I wonder what because some of the things you say aren't very flattering to psychiatrists. So I think other psychiatrists might be happy to see, well, but he's married to one, so he does understand our point of view.
And I did reveal that in the book for a very specific reason, which is, you know, the debates around these issues, especially debates around drug therapies, are hugely polarized. You have the Scientologists on one side and you have the drug companies on the other side. And there's the middle ground is a very difficult place to exist in, to say, yes, those drugs are valuable, but the science is often horrible surrounding them or not. It's not the best of our science. The science is controlled by the drug companies. The value of these drugs are overrated. The side effects are underrated. And yet they're still, you know, they're still important to have in our arsenal. And I have to say, as these drugs advances, they're important to share with the rest of the world. What the book is pointing out is that as we do this, we're sharing more than we think we're sharing. We're not just sharing the drugs. We're sharing a conception of the mind. And we're also sharing, which actually shapes the experience of illness and often shapes, changes even more fundamental cultural senses of the self. And we have to take account of that as we share our advanced knowledge with the rest of the world.
In fact, you compare that to being a virus. So what is the pathogen that has led to this outbreak of epidemics? And you say that we are this virus. We introduce American ways of treating mental illnesses, and we are, in fact, spreading the diseases.
We are spreading the diseases, or we're spreading certain types of the diseases. Oftentimes the psychopathology that is within the population exists without us. Like, so for instance, I talk about the rise of anorexia in Hong Kong. And it was during a time period where there was a very nervous time in Hong Kong. It was before, after Tiananmen Square and before the handover to British rule. Families were being broken up. Traditional ways of living were changing very fast. Women's roles were changing very fast. So that was a very nervous population. And the case I make in the book is that they did not have anorexia in Hong Kong to for the most part, until one moment in time in 1994 when a young woman died on a downtown street, and suddenly the idea of anorexia itself came to the culture. So my case is not that we spread the psychopathology that was in the population. That existed already, but there is no one way for the human mind to express it. What the human mind does at a nervous time in history like that is it looks to culture to understand what is the symptom pool for my time? What is the language of distress? And it's the unconscious mind doing this. And I often explain this to people by having them look back through history. If you look, say, for instance, to Victorian era England, where you have tens of thousands of women experiencing a symptom like hysterical leg paralysis. That's not a matter of those women faking those symptoms. That's a matter of the unstable unconscious mind looking to culture to understand what is the symptom that will allow me to express my internal distress.
You talk about a symptom pool.
Symptom pool. And those symptom pools, that's a very interesting phrase I got from a Canadian researcher named Edward Shorter, a medical historian. And he talks about symptom pools, and those symptom pools are shaped by, oftentimes very much shaped by the medical profession or the mental health profession, which says in this time, we are looking at this as the expression. So anorexia is not consistent over time. It rises and falls. Things like depression even or anxiety. If in the 70s, people that are now depressed would have expressed their distress through anxiety and they would have taken a Valium. And in the 80s and 90s, they would have talked about depression and taken an antidepressant. So these things change over time, and the mental health profession itself shapes the experience. And that's the thing we haven't yet taken account of in terms of both internationally as we take these things abroad, but also in America as well, how quickly these diagnoses change and how important the diagnosis is itself for the shaping of the illness.
My guest is Ethan Waters, and his book is Crazy Like Us. And he feels that we are exporting, well, you give the evidence that we are exporting our view of mental illness. And your book is fascinating on a lot of levels. And one of the things you mention is to imagine people from Mozambique saying, oh, these poor Americans, they just got attacked on 9/11. They're suffering trauma. We need to go over and help them do some rituals.
Yeah.
And first of all, that would sound strange to us. Well, rituals, how would that solve anything? But with the best of intentions, these people from Mozambique would come over to try to help us.
That's right. One of the anthropologists that made the cultural inappropriateness sort of clear to me by turning the tables around and asking me to imagine. And it's not just, I'm sure, we accepted the solidarity of the rest of the world after 9/11. And that does mean something, that the rest of the world would understand that we are suffering and in various ways reach out to us. But that's much different than, the healers from another culture coming over and beginning to knock on the doors of the people who had lost people in 9/11 and say, for instance, to suggest that you need to go through these rituals to begin the healing process or to release the spirits of the dead. And I think we think of other cultures as having myth-based beliefs about the mind, and we think of our culture as having scientific-based beliefs about the mind. And so it makes sense to us that we would take our science to other cultures. But in fact, things like PTSD, especially things like PTSD or depression, are very much culturally based ideas. They require an egocentric version of the mind, a way of thinking about the mind or the self, where the mind exists on top of the body and it's separated from the body and is separated from the people around you. And there's a lot of cultural ideas that are connected to that thing. So we think of it as scientific, but indeed, even when you look at over the history of the PTSD conception in our culture, you see that it's very much an evolution, a cultural evolution. It's not solid science.
And you use this word evolution because we feel that we are the evolved ones.
That's right.
We're the top of the ladder. And the Japanese, they're only 5 years behind us.
Yeah.
And the Chinese are 10 years behind the Japanese. And so we've got to bring enlightenment, scientific enlightenment to the rest of the world because we are the more evolved culture.
That's right. Even as we are the culture that appears to experience mental illness much more than other cultures, even as we're the culture that, for instance, that's with schizophrenia has one of the worst outcomes for schizophrenia, even with our drugs and our research and all the attention we pay to the disease, schizophrenics in developing nations do better. And with that sort of result, and that was a World Health Organization's 30-year-long study on schizophrenics, even with that sort of result, we tend to think that we, the rest of the world, needs to know how we do it. And it's really bizarre, given results like that, that we don't go to the rest of the world and say, okay, what can we learn from you? We need to learn from you what's how these schizophrenics tend to do better.
Because you say they do better in the underdeveloped countries than they do in industrialized countries. Schizophrenics do better. And one of the things you mentioned was there's a higher percentage in urban populations than in rural populations. And what conclusions did you draw about maybe what we should change as far as dealing with schizophrenia?
It's very interesting. We think of schizophrenia as really a biologically based thing. And undoubtedly,
brain chemistry.
It's brain chemistry. Undoubtedly, that's partly true. But that doesn't mean that culture doesn't play a part. And when you look into the literature on culture and schizophrenia, you find remarkable things. One, like you mentioned, the prevalence is not the same over the world. And the outcomes are certainly not the same over the world. And the farthest away this book took me, I went all the way down to Zanzibar, which is a little island off the Swahili coast of Africa, to spend some time with an anthropologist who was studying this question of why do schizophrenics in the developing countries do better over time?
You know, her own story was fascinating. That was a fascinating chapter for things that came out about her. But go ahead, you were saying now that she was studying.
Right. So she spent time studying three families with schizophrenics and basically charting how the families dealt with this disease. How did they talk about it? How did the ill person themselves conceive of the illness? What happens over time in interacting with this person? And the conclusion she basically came to was that in Zanzibar, it's still very common for spirit possession notions to be the explanation for this illness. And in the West, we would think certainly that would be a stigma. That would be something that you would want to get rid of, that our biological idea about mental illness would be better for that ill person to believe. And in fact, what she found was that the spirit possession notion allowed the family members to keep that ill person within the group, within the family structure. It actually was because so many people believed in spirit possession, and described their own sense of self as being possessed by spirits or being permeable to the spirit world, they, in explaining that severe mental illness in those terms, allowed the ill person to remain part of the group. And what you find with a biomedical idea about mental illness is that often is used in other cultures and in the West as a way to exclude the person from the group. Once they have that biomedical schizophrenic label, they are not part of us. They are a different, almost like a different species. And that pushes the ill person outside of the group. And it is that connection to the group, that feeling like I am still part of the family or the kinship network, or the social network, may be the very thing that allows schizophrenics in developing countries to do better over time, to have less severe symptoms over time.
I'm talking to Ethan Waters. His book is Crazy Like Us, The Globalization of the American Psyche. And you went to observe these families in Zanzibar with this anthropologist. And something interesting happened in her own life, and that her partner's daughter died.
Yes.
And you had a chance, and she had a chance to observe how he coped with this death of his daughter.
Yeah, it was a very disturbing thing. The first night I was in Zanzibar, her partner, her romantic and business partner, Ahmed, got a call at 3 a.m. to say that his daughter from another family had, a 10-year-old daughter had passed away suddenly. And I did get a chance to watch Ahmed's reaction. And Swahili men in that sort of situation tend oftentimes not to show a lot of emotion. In fact, they show a sort of very, for a Westerner, a very disorienting sort of shrug and smile and this is life sort of reaction. And I noticed that the interesting thing was not necessarily his reaction, but my reaction to his lack of expression of emotion. Because I assumed, even as I was down there to study the different cultural expressions of emotion.
You brought your own assumptions to
I could not help but look at him and think he's hiding his true emotions. He's not, and that hiding of his true emotion is going to be cause him problems in the long run. So those are American ideas that you need to express this emotion, and if you don't, something bad will happen to you down the road. And as much as I was there to try to respect the other culture's expression of emotion, I realized that I could not read his emotional language in the same way I could not understand him when he spoke Kiswahili. It was a different language, a different emotional language. And cultures do shape emotions. Emotions are not exactly the same from culture to culture, although we can recognize some of them. And in this case, I was completely at a loss to try to understand him. And it was only later, after doing more reading about how different cultures react to trauma, that I realized that his reaction was perfectly culturally appropriate.
You also studied depression, and our ideas of depression have evolved in that we think, well, gosh, everybody's depressed, so we all need medication. And therefore, how are we going to convince these poor Japanese that they are depressed? I mean, their suicide rate must indicate that they are depressed. So first we have to convince them when they're depressed, and then we can sell them the solution.
That's right. And we did this, you know, no one tried to do that during the 1990s in Japan because they really, there was an understanding of the drug companies. The drug companies are very savvy in understanding these cross-cultural differences. And there was the understanding that Japanese just did not have a label for depression that fit ours. The label, for, you know, they had one very extreme form of depression, endogenous depression, that was a severe mental illness and considered very rare. And all other forms of melancholy and sadness were in other cultural boxes. They were considered normal. In fact, not just normal, but they were considered very close to the Japanese character. The ability to experience deep sadness is something that the Japanese prized very highly. They thought of it as almost a transcendent religious experience. They thought of it as a way to find moral guidance. They did not think of it as a thing like Americans do, as a sadness, as a thing you need to get over as quickly as possible. So no one sold Prozac in Japan in the 1990s. At the very same time, it was the best-selling drug in the entire world because there wasn't a cultural, you know, connection. And then GlaxoSmithKline went in there to understand, to attempt to change that. And they very effectively marketed this American notion of depression, that being sad for more than 2 weeks in a continuous period was something that you should be very concerned about.
So they arbitrarily came up with a time limit. So if you're depressed for longer than this, then that means you need a drug.
Yeah, that time limit is in the DSM, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual. And, you know, very effectively, they basically bought off the Japanese psychiatrists. They did this what people call a mega marketing campaign that was a top-to-bottom attempt to not only sell Paxil to those very limited number of people with endogenous depression, but to sell Paxil to the common man, the person that was having the transient experience of depression.
And this conference was very lavishly funded. This person you had talked to about it was just shocked that, I mean, he thought he lived a pretty good life, but nothing compared to, and you also say that these people at the conference, though, didn't have any trouble sleeping at night. They weren't worried about this, and probably it helped that they had a high thread count of the sheets in that hotel.
Absolutely. The drug companies really throw a lot of resources behind it because they know, the people they brought to this conference, and the story I tell about the Canadian researcher was brought by GlaxoSmithKline to Kyoto. They really needed that knowledge of how cultures shape mental illness because they were trying to figure out this puzzle. And the puzzle was, how do we change this cultural conception of mental illness such that it fits our drug? And the drug companies knew it differed, and they knew they could pull these strings in this culture to change it. And they very savvily that's not a word. They very thoughtfully did this. You know, managed to do that over the first 5 years of the 2000s.
My guest is Ethan Waters. His book is Crazy Like Us, about our exportation of our view of mental illness. And we mentioned the fact that these doctors feel that they have the certainty that they have medical science backing up what they say. But they don't always reveal the whole truth when it comes to side effects, for example.
That's right.
And you have this wonderful statement by a doctor who worked for 20 years on the New England Journal of Medicine. She became convinced that the system by which drugs gain scientific status is broken. You quote her, "It is simply no longer possible to believe much of the clinical research that is published, or to rely on the judgment of trusted physicians or authoritative medical guidelines." She wrote this in the New York Review of Books. And you say, "The problems of ghostwriting and payments to researchers from the drug companies we have reach their most florid form in the field of psychiatry and the studies of SSRIs. The science behind SSRIs, these antidepressants, used to justify their sale in other cultures has proven to be suspect at best.
Yes, absolutely. The science, and this again is not to say that SSRIs and antidepressants are not valuable in some cases, but the pipeline of science that these ideas have gone through has been controlled by the drug companies from the very beginning. The setting up of the studies, the paying of researchers that do the studies, the ghostwriting of these papers has all been funded by the drug companies, and then it goes through the marketing arms of these drug companies, and what comes out in the end really looks nothing like science. And this has been an enormous scandal, and one that Charles Grassley in the Senate has held some very revealing hearings on, and we need to pay more attention to it. And again, this is not a matter of no psychiatric drugs are good, but this is a matter of the science behind them. We have to understand how they affect people, and we can't have the side effects hidden from us, and we have to have a valid understanding of their worth if we're going to use them, and certainly if we're going to take them around, on a roadshow around the world. We need to share our science with the world, but that science has to have some validity, and we need to restructure how that science is being made because it cannot be controlled by the drug companies themselves.
So you say that we need to respect and these countries, if they do have upheaval in disasters, that they need respect, not therapy. And we think that we have the therapy for them.
That's right.
In our moral certainty that that's the case. And you were mentioning in Japan, you said we marketed the disease along with the drug. So we first had to market the drug. The disease to get them to buy the drug. Your book is so interesting, and I do hope a lot of people read it because I don't think they're going to hear it on the evening news where the pharmaceutical companies sponsor ABC and NBC. Anytime you turn on the evening news, you're going to get a pharmaceutical ad. So yours is the voice that I hope will be heard. It's been such a pleasure talking to you.
Oh, I've really enjoyed it. Thank you so much.
My guest has been Ethan Waters. His book is Crazy Like Us, The Globalization of the American Psyche. I'd also like to thank my first guest, Dr. Lisa Benaron, author of Autism.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf, a production of North State Public Radio. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org.